This podcast is made possible by financial support from our listeners. If you're not supporting us yet, check out 90milesfromneedles.com/donate or text the word needles to 53555.
One of the experiences I had out here with the land and the animals, we were growing watermelons, and I had a good few hundred watermelons out there, and I was like, oh man, I'm gonna pick first thing Monday morning. Went home for the weekend, came back, and heard the coyotes that morning. I knew they were out here. I come running out here, and sure enough, there's a couple in the fenced in area, and they're leaving, and there's some that went under, some that climbed over, but there's a couple of packs of them. And I was yelling at him, getting mad. Darn you, snob. I was like, it's war. And I noticed there's two big red-tailed hawks sitting up in the highest willow tree right there. They're watching them. They seen everything. They witnessed everything. And I looked at them, and they seen me. And mad, and I get in my truck. I'm going to go chase them down. So they took to the air like that. And then they went, flew over them. And coyote was running over this way, kind of over towards where we're sitting at right now. And the red-tails flew over. And the coyotes were just trotting along like no big deal. And the next thing you know, the redtails were dipping down and they were attacking them and clawing their backs and they're yelping, arf, arf, and their butts would go to the ground, ow, ow, and they run. And those two redtails just kept dive bombing them and attacking them and yelping them, and they started running and took off like that. And just as I was coming through the other side, I seen that. And I think I caught it on video, just one of them as they attacked when he's coming this way. It just blew me away. Wow, they felt my heart. Uh-huh. They felt they seen my work, the work that we put into the land and all that, waiting for harvest. And then they seen what coyotes did. And then they felt my heart when I was angry. And they were angry too, because they felt my heart. And they knew that the coyote was no good, that they were bad. What they did was bad. And so they went and let the coyote know that's bad.
To be able to witness that and experience that, is just, you can't put it into words. You can't express the connection of the myself, the watermelons, the coyotes, and the redtail, and the land, and the water, uh-huh. and the air.
Think the deserts are barren wastelands? Think again. It's time for 90 Miles from Needles, the Desert Protection Podcast.
Water in the service of man. It's California's Parker Dam, a 40 million pound project to carry water to the arid plain of Southern California. From the dam reservoir, water is pumped 300 feet up over a mountaintop, along a pipeline 400 miles long, to bring power to factories, fertility to the farms, and drinking water to a dozen great cities, to make rich California richer still.
By the 1920s, the communities of the coastal plain surrounding the city of Los Angeles were stymied. Individually, they could not support a new water delivery system, but collectively, a cooperative venture was the answer, and the dream began to unfold. Initially, 13 communities formed the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California and embarked on a water project of monumental proportions.
The new Metropolitan Water District launched a bond drive to raise $220 million to build an aqueduct. These metropolitan pioneers would soon start the largest water project in history. In 1933, work began on one of the world's most formidable construction feats ever, the 242-mile aqueduct through one of the world's harshest deserts. Work started on Parker Dam in 1934. This dam would feed Colorado River water into the aqueduct. Parker Dam was finished in 1938. People came from miles around to see the first waters of the Colorado fill the dam. By June 1941, the first Colorado River water rolled into LA.
Hey everyone, welcome to yet another episode of 90 Miles from Needles, the Desert Protection Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Clark. It is really straightforward to find material online about the environmental cost of putting all those dams on the Colorado River that went in the middle of the 20th century from the 1930s to the 1960s. But there is something that, as far as I can tell, is unmentioned in any of the histories. Lake Havasu is the impoundment behind Parker Dam of the Colorado River. It was put in order to feed Colorado River water into the Colorado River Aqueduct, constructed by the Metropolitan Water District in the 1930s. The aqueduct is really foundational to life in Southern California. It underlies pretty much everything you're able to do in Southern California from a lifestyle or economic perspective. The place would look a lot different if it wasn't for the Colorado River Aqueduct. And you'll sometimes hear about the engineering accomplishment that is Parker Dam, the deepest dam in the world. They had to go almost 250 feet down into the sediment at the bottom of the river before they hit sturdy bedrock. It's 320 feet high, but only 85 feet of that is above water. You can find stories about how London Bridge ended up in Lake Havasu. You can find citations that the total capacity of Lake Havasu is around 2/3 of a million acre feet. We don't know whether that takes into account the siltation that has happened over the course of the last 90 years. There's even a sort of quaint little story about the Arizona-California war that the building of the Parker Dam precipitated, with the governor of Arizona calling out the Arizona National Guard to occupy the land on the east side of the river so that they could block construction of the dam. He was upset because that water was going to go to the LA suburbs instead of Phoenix and Tucson. There are lots of things you can find out about Parker Dam and Lake Havasu online. But something that's really hard to find anything about, in fact, in quite a number of days of doing the research for this episode, I found nothing on this, was the impact of the building of Parker Dam and the flooding of Lake Havasu on the people that lived where Lake Havasu went. I'm talking about the Chemehuevi people in this particular instance. There are other native peoples along the river as well. The Chemehuevi, who refer to themselves as New Wu, farmed and lived for generations on the banks of the Colorado River in the fertile soil that came with the annual floods. But when it came time to build the Parker Dam and flood Lake Havasu, the concerns of the Chemehuevi people and their continued livelihood there, their cultural continuity, was deemed absolutely unimportant by the builders. And so the Chemehuevi people were forced to leave their homes to make way for Lake Havasu. They lost almost 8,000 acres of tillable land that they had worked for generations. Over the course of the last year or so, I've gotten to know this guy, a son of a friend of mine, who's attempting to restore some of the agricultural lifeways of the Chemehuevi. Up above the waterline, a mile or so from the western shore of Lake Havasu, I'm going to let him introduce himself.
Marcus Garium, Nuk Nu, Nuk Tumuev, Nuk Tatuvas Nu, Nuk Mohumputs, Nuk Suavats. Hello, my name is Daniel Lavis. I'm Southern Paiute Chemehuevi from Lake Havasu, known as Suavit. I'm the farm manager of the Chemehuevi Indian tribe. My grandmother calls me Mohumputs. That means owl. Because I always said, who, grandma, who? So she said, you're Mohumputs. Sound like a little owl. So I grew up with that as my identity. It's Mohumputs. I'd like to welcome you all to the non-organic traditional farm we have here. This farm represents a return to an understanding and a way of being of our ancestors. In order to do that, we must honor the likeness and memory of who we are through them. In order to do that through them, we must remember and recall that our ancestors are beneath the lake. So in essence, we resurrect their spirit in being through the land to represent a living way that we once lived before the formation of Lake Havasu. Displaced was 7,776 acres of fertile farmlands from the people in the formation of the lake. The tribe was established in 1907 and were later removed after the formation of Metropolitan Water District and the plan to build Parker Dam for a reservoir for Central Arizona and Southwest California. As the waters was rising, my grandparents were removed from this land. Not a lot of the people returned to the land after the tribe was federally recognized in 1970. And those that have brought back the hopes and dreams of memories of a place that once existed known as Suava, that's under the lake. The water is life. It has the power to create and has the power to take life as well.
Daniel and I meet at the Chemehuevi Tribal Agricultural Department headquarters, which is off a little ways from the houses on the reservation. We hop into a tribal truck and Daniel drives me through the farm area, pointing out a bunch of different interesting things as we go. We drive past a big open field. At the other end of it, against a row of trees, there's a couple of circular patches, maybe about 30 feet wide each. And they show healthy-looking seedlings of corn and squash and beans and a couple other plants I can't quite identify.
Up here we got the Greenhouse High Tunnel Project. It's an NRCS grant. And we got three greenhouses that we're growing in currently on one of them. And we got the power infrastructure being installed on the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I noticed is the soil. Some of them aren't growing as well as others. These ones had more water, so I then reduced the water to these ones that had it dammed off. And so they're getting too much water, but the ones that were getting, I thought were getting the least amount of water, they grew great.
Yeah.
So it's a learning process.
So that's squash there?
That's squash, zucchini. Then on this side, we got peppers and tomatoes. And one of these, I want to just concentrate to grow nothing but like traditional medicinal foods, like traditional vegetables and stuff like that, or you know, dedicate one completely to like chilies and salsa making, it's like a salsa. And we got some dwarf lemon trees that we just put in, 20 dwarf lemon trees. We have these standard lemon trees in here and with pomegranates,
mm-hmm.
and they're just all over those trees. There's a bunch this year because we cleared it out and got all the overgrowth out and found out there's earthworm production in that soil. So it's a living
nice.
Soil in there. And these trees have came back. They were pecans planted over 10 years ago, but they weren't getting enough water, but they survived. A few of them survived. And when we cleaned it out, I was noticed there's pecans on them. They're old and dried up, but they're producers. I was made aware of an 1800 strains of Chemehuevi corn and contacted by Native Seed Search, and I found out there's these Chemehuevi strain that was grown from 20 seeds and grown to about a sixth generation, then crossbreed with a Mojave Sweet, I believe. And then from those seeds, then now I believe I have a 10th generation seed of a mid-1800 strain of Chemehuevi corn. And our partnership or agreement with them is to get 1/4 yield of production so they can grow their seed. And I grew it in circles and bundles. My primary design was the center point, north, south, east, west, and the diagonal points, northwest, southwest, and so on. And the second circle is a spiral based in the four directions. I've seen some diagrams that have talked about the Big Dipper and the North Star. We have a story of our people about the bighorn sheep and the star, North Star. But each season, it's in a different position, and if you were to put all those positions together, it'd make the swastika, or like the universal life spiral diagram. So I modeled that spiral after that four-directional diagram, and I planted the corn in that pattern. And it rings around the outside with squash, and within it on I planted tepary beans, and you see the tepary beans growing alongside it.
Yeah.
I might have to hit it with some manure just to bring up some nutrients.
Yeah, when my wife and I moved into the place we have now, I tried to plant some tepary beans, and the iguanas ate them all.
Oh, wow.
They just came in, and they're pulling them up, eating the leaves, eating the stems.
Good.
Yeah. I gotta say, I didn't really mind, because it was just... I like the iguanas so much.
It was worth it to grow it to see them feast on it.
Yeah.
That's the connection. See, that's the connection out here that I was able to experience. And before it was just these north-south mesquite lines and mm-hmm. this east-west willow line. And this willow line had then been choked out by all the mesquite and growing. There's not enough water to keep them growing well. Because they went into shock too in 2019 when we had pump issues, and a brand new pump put in. It was a EQIP grant for one-time pump replacement through NRCS. It was 90% less emissions on this newer pump compared to the old pump. On a California EPA standard, we were able to switch it out. My father came in and did a lot of clearing and did a lot of leveling. I came on and worked with him, and we had begun to develop a tree line network because we noticed the sands and the winds were just devastating any crop, just putting holes in the leaves and just sandblasted, and this blow sand blows in, blows out, and it'll destroy whatever's in its path. So one way to avoid that is to start these tree line networks. So we built these ditches and let the tree lines evolve. We planted mesquite and willow. And some places they took real good and some places they didn't. But we developed this tree line network to help assist with the wind as wind breaks.
Daniel's father is Matt Lavis Sr. He's a good friend of mine. He's a founder and board member of the Native American Land Conservancy and a friend of the podcast. You can hear him taking part in our episode commemorating our mutual friend Phil Klasky, Season 1, Episode 10. Take a look for that episode. Give it a listen. You won't be sorry. Back to the farm.
You got a couple of palm trees that snuck in there.
Yeah, there's a lot. When coyotes eat the palms, they eat the seeds and they plant them everywhere.
Yeah.
And so a lot of those palms, these are the California palms, and we use them. The seeds, they go into our gourds and that we use for our cultural and traditional songs.
Nice. Those fruits taste pretty good too.
The palm?
Yep.
I never tried it.
Oh, it's so sweet.
Oh, really?
Yep. There's no flesh to it. It's just like a sweet skin around the hard seed.
Ah, okay.
But if you see some still on the tree, you don't want to pick them off the ground because a coyote probably ate them. I did that once. I picked one off the ground, put it in my mouth, and realized that it had gone through a coyote first. It wasn't the worst experience I had that day, even. But
just the thought, though.
But if you get it off the tree, it's just the sweetest thing in the world.
So that's why they eat them, because they eat up my melons. I've been at war with the coyotes for years, just attacking my melons, and they attack them. Like, I guess I've been picking them too late, and they're ripe. When the coyotes get them, they tear them up. They went through that fenced-in area. They had hundreds in there one time, three rows of just 100 melons. And they went in one weekend. A few, you can see where they dug in multiple areas. We had packs of coyotes coming here competing for those melons, and they're hearing yelping, they're going to war, and you come back the next morning, you just see just the melon carcass everywhere. They're all gone. They'll get go through 100 melons in a night. This area is our cultural area. We have cultural gatherings here at our winter camp. We want to encircle it with our cottonwoods.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who come out, and we have our gatherings. Everybody always has a good feel. So what we have here is 80 acres of our traditional all-organic farm. With the formation of Lake Havasu, we had lost 7,776 acres of fertile farmlands under the lake. And with that, the living ways of the people that lived with the big cottonwoods, within the cottonwoods and the trees and the ecosystem that was there. And the formation of the lake, and then we were removed from this area, and the lake was formed, and my grandparents were here when they were removed. One of my grandmothers went over Whipple Mountain, which we call Wyethu, by wagon. And my other grandmother was here. Her name was Pearl Smith Eddy. She remembers the water rising and the birds falling into the water, not making it from all the cottonwoods in the middle. Oh. And I'm holding a big powwow, and all the water was rising, trying to just to hold on to a way of life, and the way of life was just going before our eyes. So the lake was formed, and my father and his brother, after moving up here, and the tribe was established in 1970, they had a dream of agriculture here, but we had no real fertile farmlands. So up here on the mesa, my father and his brother seen the potential for agricultural land if we just develop it.
they leased land, and it later then become and developed into the agriculture department. And so this agriculture began with the hopes and dreams of people instilled by my grandmother by the time she was here, into the hearts of my father. They come up here with that hopes and dreams and to give it to the land so the land can then give it back to the people. And that's where we're at now. And in a way, we're resurrecting Suava Uts. Suava Uts is the place of mortars, is a place of gravel water, a place of brush. And that was this place. It's a sacred area, not just to us, to the Amakav to the north, and Kanawha to the south. And from the time of creation, the Chemehuevi believe our salt song trail began and end here, down by the Bill Williams River, the rock house and salt cave, mm-hmm. where the dreamers dreamed the song. So in essence of getting back to land restoration and cultural restoration and linguistic restoration and even identity, our own self-identity, we're always being told who we are by others, that we don't know who we are. When we learn who we are, we stand on that. And it lights the way of understanding, and the picture is painted. And the picture that I see, understand, is not a blue lake, but of a green, brushy, living area. The people lived in a living way with the water and the land. Cagapa, red water. The Spaniards call it Colorado. The Red River. So we were here before the Spanish. We call it Ancagapa. Ancagas, red, Paz, water. As I learn, I'm expressing things in a new way, because it's like, in a way, we have to go back to the beginning and learn our creation story and learn everything through that to the now. And when we do that, we can see the westernized ways or the other ways of influence that determine how we think and how we self-identify and how we look at each other. Now, when we start to understand and take it back to the spiral of creation, the great spiral of life, where all life is interwoven through this dynamic connection that's all woven together through energy, through being, through history, through now. It's just the spiral of life is like a basket, and generation to generation overlaps over time and eras, and they're woven together. And what we're experiencing now is at the end of the basket, where the weave is frayed. Everything is singular in a way of understanding and separated, just like we are separate from ourselves, from each other, in our own boxes, in our own lands, in our own labels. When we get back to the center of creation, we begin to reweave the interconnectedness that we have, and we are not as set apart as we are told that we are based on these names placed on us. We are more interwoven than we realize. All the peoples that are connected to the land, that are connected to other peoples that are connected to the land, are woven together in language and song and being. And being able to understand that through seeing how life evolves out here on the farm, you know, it's really amazing. It's a real blessing to witness the connection with the land and the spirits, the animals. It's just very enlightening, and you see a purpose in a place by lifting the waters and giving the waters to the land. The land gives back and heals. And just understanding that flow of energy, of life in a living way, it's pretty amazing. And here we are, we're just all in this technological advanced way, and we're so disconnected to a natural order or ways. I've been here for thousands of years. For thousands of years, people's lived in a living way with the land and their place, just like the animals, as we are no different, no better than them, and they're a reflection of us, and we are a reflection of them.
Is there a place where we could get out of the truck and get away from the engine noise a little bit?
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. We'll probably go down here, you hear flowing water.
All right, that works.
We turn onto a side road and head toward those circular patches of corn and beans and squash. It feels good to hop out of the truck, stretch my legs, and get my feet onto the upturned soil. It's been a long day of driving for me at this point. Nearby, a 2-inch PVC pipe is gushing out water into a small canal that flows toward the tree line. Daniel moves the pipe over a couple of feet so that it floods the beds with the corn and squash instead.
Now, these are devil's claw. They grow like an okra, And it's real sticky leaf underneath, and it real stinks like dead, almost like dead something. The devil's claw we would use for the black on our basket design, our basket tree. I believe the roots have some type of medicinal property as far as the aspirin or help kill pain for back pain or something. But the okra, I guess you can chop it up and fry it up when they're still soft and it's edible. Then when the okra dries up, it'll split into two, and that would be the devil's claw. And the seeds are edible, like sunflower seeds. And see, this is the spiral right here for the corn. You can see the where it goes off, and then it goes out into the spiral,
mm-hmm.
and it goes out. So you follow that one in, go all the way around. Right here, and it goes all the way around. Something like that.
Very cool.
I want to plant some squash in here also. Something got to these guys and ate them up. I think maybe a donkey can, because there's some of them that were topped off, and I think he chewed some up. So it was really awesome to have the opportunity to grow this strain of Chemehuevi corn in light of this farm and what it represents to us in spirit as far as Suavuts and a living system, ecosystem. I'm going to try to bring some of that back, get some of the soil generated kind of direction we're going is for our green waste. There's a soil mitigation plan. We just did had the whole plot tested, and I got to send those samples in so we can get a picture of the nutrients in the land. And I have a few zones concentrated on to where we're going to grow, do our primary grow. And it's mainly in here on the other side over there where the tree line, where the citrus trees are. But yeah, but part of the soil mitigation plan as far as green waste we wanted to develop would be composting, the green waste to compost. The concept of the green waste composting is a fungus-based compost that has a lot of benefits as far as creating a web of subsoil communications through the nitrates in the roots of the plants, from the way I understand it. And to in light of a lot of our challenges here with soil, because there's a lot of different materials. There's good sand and good material in here, but if we were to enrich it, it'd be that much better. We have earthworms in this plot to be able to grow them and harvest them and cultivate them. That'd be one of the benefits of green waste soil mm-hmm. enrichment. We have a tree nursery on the scope that would use a lot of composting and mulching for. A lot of benefits for all these different aspects that to come together and help each other for the same purpose, the same cause. We get rid of our green waste, turn it into soil, turn that soil back into the land and enrich the better. So we're just trying to come together and develop a plan towards that and carve out this ecosystem, you know, this ecosystem that evolved out here, you know. It reflects a living, a way to live with the land and heal the land, and the land will heal you in more ways than one, in mind, body, and spirit. It's just amazing to be connected out here to this farm, land to see it evolve and grow from just clear cut to network tree lines and gardens within. You can hear that by the birds, and hear that by the animals out here, and you see that by just all the life. There's just so much from the micro, you know, monarch butterflies, all these different small birds, different type of birds you've never seen before, or never heard before. Migrating in, migrating out, coyotes, deer, raccoons, rabbits, jackrabbits, little gophers, little squirrels, lizards, blackbirds, dove, quail. You can hear them over there right now. Yeah. Aww.
Yeah. One of my favorites.
Yeah, the sound of the quail. And then there's the community right there to the south. And I brought one of the community members out here. They came out to talk about green waste. I gave them a place to dump the green waste and help them grow some trees too and get some trim. And I showed them these areas within here, and they're blown away. Wow, I didn't know this is all out here. And we just drive by it every day. We just drive by it every day. It's like, yeah, a lot of people drive by it every day, don't really come out and feel the land. Feel the way the birds sound, the way they make you feel. Peace that comes to you just by hearing a simple bird song. And bugs flying by your ear.
Flash flood coming our way here.
Yeah, we're right in the middle. Like how the microcosm of all the sand characteristics, and you go drive across the land, and oh, I know how that was formed. All this was formed by water. You can see how it reflects from the micro to the like to the mountains and the hills that surround us. And that's another aspect that's just amazing to see the land and the water and how they connect and influence each other. Still want to carve out the spiral more in the ditch, and so the water flows. What would be cool is to get the water to flow from each four corner to the center point all at the same time. I think that's what I want to try to focus on eventually in the future when I keep developing these growth circles and stuff. Or to have it go to the center out or something, like some type of flow, like energy. So think about water and energy, it always flows, frequency, it always flows. Everything has amplitude and amplitude. It's like in life, we're just a flow. Flow of energy, kinetic energy, water flowing over the rocks is creating energy. It's energizing this water to bring life to the land. Anything it touches will bring life. Any seeds that it touches is energized by flowing over the rocks. When water flows over the rocks, it creates energy because of the energy of the rocks. The rocks have energy because they're solid, but if you know anything about science, you know that everything that looks solid just appears solid to our senses. But everything's moving, everything's vibrating, everything's pulsing in the frequency of life. You see all the different deposits, you see these are heavier, so they collect differently than the rest of it.
Yep.
You got the light sand being pushed very easily. I try to keep this guy from overflowing too much. I'm always filling it in, and it's always washing back out.
Yep.
Just to try to get that little level in.
Daniel says he feels the urge to sing to the garden, and who am I to argue?
The song is about West Well, we call it Hawaii, where we go and get our water to drink.
This is gonna be my fire circle.
The purpose of this is to build a fire so that ash will be used to put around the stalks of the corn, and that discourages the larva from crawling up to where you get earworms and all that. So that's a Hopi practice, I believe, or Hopi blue corn.
This makes me happy right here.
That's the screw beam.
Yep. In 2020, I planted one in our yard that was a little bit smaller than that. And it's taller than either of us now.
Oh, wow, yeah.
It's doing really good.
Yeah, these are survivors because these got disced up. See like where they got disced up at, where they got mangled up right here, see?
Yep.
They got mangled up, but then they grew out. They stayed rooted. Same thing with those. All these got disced up.
Tough guys.
Tough roots, yep. Yes, sir.
And with that, we got back in the truck. About halfway back to the Ag Department headquarters, we met a very young coyote. He couldn't have been more than 4 or 5 months old. He darted across the road in front of us, sort of leisurely-like, maybe darting's the wrong word. And then he went and hid in a large drainage pipe. But he didn't hide very well. He was looking at us curiously with his head poking out of the end of the pipe. It was comical, and I have to say, it was a pretty nice moment.
If people listening to this episode were going to take just one or two things away from listening, what would you want those to be?
I guess it would be the connection to the land in spirit as a people in the past, present, and future, but mainly in this moment, to be able to see the dynamic symmetric patterns of life and how they interweave and interconnect, and you know, in the land, in the water, air, animals, spirit, life, the sustainability of living ways and living ecosystem, living habitat. And just to have a peek into that would be good. If I could paint that picture or that connection of the land and the people and the spirit of life, that'd be great. Be a gift of insight.
If you could travel like 50 or 60 years down the road, what would you hope to see coming out of the work that you're doing here today?
I'd like to see a self-sustained, living, all-organic, traditional, cultural, learning farm. A living way, like a gift to the people. Like, in 50 years, I'd imagine all of this wash that goes down to Catfish Bay green, all of this land up here just green, all around the mesa, just a greenery, just a rebirth of the land the water drank, and the time the water drank the land, and life changed forever. So to resurrect that in spirit, and to reflect on that in a living way, that'd be something good. Roadrunner over there.
Oh, nice.
And Atumawev. So we call ourselves Atumawev. Run with their head down, nose up. And Chimwevies were known as good runners. They'd run all over and taking message, taking the information. A pathway for a group would take 4 or 5 days up north through mountain to mountain. Or there's another path that would take 2 to 3 days for the runners. Maybe even shorter with good runners. They get the message up north to the people up north that, hey, the group's coming up. Say the hunter's out, get something to eat, prepare for a feast. Or we're bringing somebody home to sing them home, sing them to the stars. Hey, we got a yagat, or we got a cry. Calling all singers. It'll take 5 days, 6 days to get from place to place. A few days, 3 days, from 2 days, 3 days from here to 29 Palms, or up the river to Cottonwood Island, or down south to Yuma, or the Palo Verde bands and groups. A totally different way of living, of just traveling by foot, and it's just a way of life. It goes without saying, we walked everywhere. So we're probably pretty healthy, had to live off the land to be able to have the strength to walk across it from place to place, migrate with the seasons and the growth and the gathering and the hunting. Winters and summers affected both, and so we lived accordingly. And we're just learning of that, of those ways and those connections. As Chimwevi out here, after what happened with the removal of our people from this lake and this land, the disconnect, assimilation, the boarding school system, and then come back and try to be whole again when it was whipped out of you, and then they teach it and they try to whip it into you. it's challenging to resurrect the essence of who we are in this place, the Shivawak band, and the Sawaba Huts band. I'm Duvaz Nuwu.
Thank you for showing me around and taking the time to talk to the listeners a little bit.
That was a great morning. Everything I shared with you has just been a long road of evolution. I believe I have pictures of when there was nothing out there and think there was just two tree lines and everything was just brown and clear cut. To see that, see what it's become now, it's amazing. And we just witnessed that with that little new life, that little coyote coming into the land. That's what it's about right there. That's what it's all about. We are no greater than the animals. The animals are no greater than us. And we are equals in this land because we both have the desire to live. And we both breathe air, drink water, and we both gather from the land and eat from the land. It's just today in this matrix, we go to the store now.
All right. And that wraps up yet another episode of 90 Miles from Needles, the Desert Protection Podcast. I want to thank very deeply Mr. Daniel Levis for spending the morning with me. He has a lot of work to do on the farm, as farms go, and he spent the morning with me anyway, showing me around, letting me be a tourist. It was a really good time, and I'm very appreciative, and I hope all of you listening were too. I would also like to thank Travis Puglisi and Anna Stump and Zachary Peckler for joining our merry band of financial supporters. This isn't Travis's first rodeo. He pitched in some time ago fairly generously, but this time around he noted on social media that he really liked the Ancient Plants episode, and we are glad that he did. I also want to thank Joe Jeffrey, our voiceover artist, and Martine Mancha, our art artist, for their contributions to this episode and the podcast in general. Our theme song, Moody Western, is by Brightside Studio. If you are not yet helping to support 90 Miles from Needles and the Desert Advocacy Media Network that is our nonprofit home, you can fix that by going to 90milesfromneedles.com/donate. You will find a couple of different options for giving us some money there. You can also text the word needles to 53555. That will bring you, in response to your text, a form that you can fill out and pay with whatever you've got set up on your phone, Apple Pay, Google Pay, PayPal, whatever. We are non-judgmental and platform independent around here. You can make a small donation or a bigger one. You can donate recurring on a monthly or annual basis or just the one time. We are all about choice here. We hope you liked this episode. We are very, very grateful that you're listening. Take care of yourself. The desert's getting hotter and hotter. Caution as we go outside is ever more important. And if we all make it, I will see you at the next watering hole. Bye now. Thank you.
90 Miles from Needles is a production of the Desert Advocacy Media Network.